Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Armed with a PhD in economics and policy experience, Dave Beiser hit Wall Street, landing at Lehman Brothers in structured equity derivatives in the early 1990s. A deep background in option pricing theory notwithstanding, he soon found that concepts like Ito's lemma were less important than helping clients solve practical problems, like hedging equity risk in a tax-efficient manner. Developing a keen understanding of the tax code as it pertained to derivatives, Dave was among the innovators in product development in this area. Leaving the U.S. for London in the pre-financial crisis period, Dave was head of European and EMEA fixed income. Our conversation explores the investor appetite for European structured products and the manner in which risks were recycled to hedge funds. Turning to Dave's transition to the buy side, we learn of the framework he utilizes at GCW, the wealth management firm he co-founded. Dave shares his views on equilibrium option pricing, seeing the clearing price for insurance as generally reflecting a risk-averse investor's desire to truncate the potential for unwanted outcomes. On the long side of the portfolio, Dave and team believe that there is tremendous price discovery already incorporated into liquid on-the-run public equities, and as a result, finding alpha is difficult. The search for superior risk-adjusted returns is better focused in understanding complex, difficult-to-value situations that may be found in smaller cap equities or in private markets. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with Dave Beiser. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is Dave Beiser. He is the co-founder and managing partner of GCW. Dave, it's great to have you on the podcast today.
Thrilled to be here, Dean. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. You were my boss. It's coming up on just a quarter century ago. So going back a little bit of ways there, you and I worked together at Lehman Brothers. You've got a really interesting start in finance and Wall Street from the academic side. Why don't you take us through all the way back to your early days in academia, and then we can pivot to how you got started on Wall Street.
Starting back in college, I was an econ major, and at the time I felt like the way economics was taught to undergraduates made like no sense to me. I did well in the classes, but I just came out of them not really having a deep understanding of how things worked. And so I decided to go to graduate school and get a PhD in economics. And I did that. And before long, the next thing I knew, I was on the academic job market and started my career as an assistant professor. I did that for about 3 years. And then one of my professors from my graduate school, a guy named Michael Boskin, had become the chairman of the CEA under George Bush Sr., the first Bush administration. And he asked me to come work with him. And I was, I had just my head down. I was working on lecture notes and trying to write papers for publication. And so I couldn't really think about it. But after a while, I started to think, it would be a lot of fun to go to Washington and work on some kind of more practical problems while I was in academia. I took a leave of absence and went to DC. And it was a great experience. I really enjoyed it. I was learning so much. The way the Council of Economic Advisors works is there's a three-person board, and then there are sort of a handful of senior economists sort of deployed by subject. And so, for example, there's a labor economist, a health economist, and I was the financial markets person, which meant through my purview was covering the SEC, the Fed, many aspects of the Treasury, and some of the smaller agencies. And I just got involved with so many fascinating things. It kind of tapped a set of skills that I either had to develop or maybe surprised myself that I had. Either take your pick. Either way, I really enjoyed it. And so rather than go back to academia after that stint, I decided to go into banking. So I moved up to New York, which is, I think it was only a few years later, you and I started working together.
I was just going to say, it's so interesting, your background and theoretical aspects of finance and economics. And I think throughout this conversation, what I would love to weave in is just some of your perspective on that theoretical framework, those equilibrium type models, and then just some of the vast malfunction that we see in markets, whether it's negative prices for crude oil or negative interest rates. It'll be great to get your perspective. So you moved to New York, and was that when you joined Lehman Brothers?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I came up to New York to join Lehman. And I don't know about you, Dean, but my view was that was just a great experience. It was a great group of people, really, really smart people, really focused. There was a lot of entrepreneurial spirit, and it was fun.
Your tenure at Lehman Brothers went all the way through, and I'd love to get more of that arc. My sense is, especially in the maybe early 2000s, the culture and the combination of culture and accomplishment at the same time for the Lehman Brothers crowd was quite substantial. And so you saw the strong arc of it. Walk us through that a little bit, just from a high level, in terms of your ascendancy towards more responsibility in terms of the types of things that you were doing. I know you started in equities and ultimately had a significant role in the fixed income side as well. Tell us a little bit more about your trajectory at Lehman Brothers.
Well, I started on the structured equity derivatives marketing desk. That was kind of a combined, at that time at Lehman's, combined structuring and marketing. There weren't separate groups, although later on, so the functions bifurcated into two independent teams. So at that time, we were all the same team, and you know, we were covering insurance companies, hedge funds, in principle, any institutional counterparty. And I remember, I remember the two leaders of that desk. I'm not going to mention their names because I don't have their permission to do so. But I remember looking at those leaders who had very different backgrounds than I did coming into it. And they were both really so good at their jobs. I looked at them and I thought, it's going to be impossible for me to succeed because I'm not like them at all. And then ultimately what I did was I tried to think of, well, what was it about their approach to doing business that I thought I could sort of incorporate into my operating behavior, my thought process, what would work with my personality basically. And I sort of identified those things with from those two guys. And I tried to adopt basically the best of those two guys. You know, you never know. You know this as well as I did, Dean. You know, you start covering clients and you talk to them about trades. You don't know if they're actually going to do the trade you're talking to them about. You don't know if they do that trade, if they're going to do it with you. There's a tremendous amount of uncertainty and insecurity about whether you're going to be successful. But I found that there were a few clients with whom I established a dialogue that was effective. And it was maybe a little bit more based on sort of more fundamental financial considerations than other things. I was never really kind of the guy who would go out golfing with the clients. I'm a pathetic golfer. So glad that wasn't important. And so I started getting traction with my client base. The way banking works is success begets greater responsibilities. And so I was asked to do sort of more broader roles. And I think you had left. What year did you leave, Dean?
I think 1999.
Yeah. Okay. So after you left around late 2002, and we're skipping over maybe a time that you want to come back to some point in this conversation, because a lot happened between those two dates, including 9/11. But around 2002, the firm asked me and my current partner and co-founder of GCW asked both of us to move to Europe to help resurrect, you know, a once successful derivatives business in Europe that had fallen on more recent hard times. So we both moved to Europe. And that was a wonderful experience because there was an incredibly talented team there that was just yearning to be successful again. They were all so focused. So that worked out really well. And I think I had maybe a couple of more other roles before the music stopped with the Lehman bankruptcy. At that point, the way the bankruptcy went for Lehman employees was that there was basically a schism between the U.S. business and the international businesses. And the U.S. business was bought by Barclays. And most of the international businesses were bought, as in like literally acquired, by Nomura, but there was one business that was not, and that was European fixed income, which at the time of the bankruptcy, I was managing sales, fixed income sales for Europe and the Middle East. It was the one major business that was not acquired. And it was because Nomura had concern about the balance sheet of that business. Maybe there are some other sort of liabilities that it didn't want to undertake. And so it's, rather than acquire the entire business, like every other business that Lehman had been acquired, it basically just hired a third of the people out of European fixed income. So of the roughly 600 people in European fixed income, about 200 got hired. So that was a very difficult and unpleasant process. Whether you were hired or not, it was just a painful thing to go through. People moved over to Nomura. That firm treated, I thought, everyone, you know, extremely well. But for me, there was a client that I had worked with for many years that was a West Coast-based client, and I'd been talking to them about combining, about joining them. And once sort of everyone got settled down into the Nomura family, I made the change and left and joined that other firm in California.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to talk about the buy side experience versus the sell side experience. And then also, as you mentioned, this move to Europe, that set of products and clients is unique and different relative to the US. So I'd love to explore that too. Before we do that, I think it'd be great to learn a little bit more about your, what I would consider to be a unique approach, which is clearly understanding the math of optionality and the models that drive these prices and risk sensitivities, but also this keen understanding of tax and regulatory matters and how tax code sometimes becomes a motivating factor for implementation of various trades. Sometimes there's a hedging trade that also brings with it some tax reconstitution. And I think you've done a lot of that. I certainly learned a lot working for you during that time in the late 90s. Just broadly, if you can, not to obviously dive into any specifics on the tax code, but that's just such a unique skill set that you brought. And it'd be great to hear from your perspective the early days of you becoming aware of some of these maybe inconsistencies and how they might be capitalized on from a client standpoint, because that was a big part of your approach.
It was something I didn't really anticipate at the time that I joined the equity derivative business. I really knew nothing about as a business line. I used to think to myself, I knew a lot about option pricing and Ito's lemma. That wasn't too useful at Lehman Brothers. But what I discovered was, what was really useful was understanding where there could be other motivations for choosing a form of transaction that might maybe had similar economic payoffs to other forms, but was treated differently for other reasons. And a good example of one of those different treatments is tax. And these things have evolved over time. So, you know, things that might have been true mid-90s are not necessarily true today because the rules evolve. And what happens is that clients and their tax advisors and banks find areas of the tax code where the code may be respected form more than function, so to speak. And so the form of transaction then could dictate the tax treatment and make one form of transaction more advantageous on an after-tax basis than another form of transaction. Now, if it was really egregious, so to speak, then it usually would come to light and those things end up being called loopholes. And those loopholes then get closed and people move on to other things. A good example of that was what was then sort of famously referred to as the Lauder transaction. And all I know about this is frankly what I read in the New York Times at the time, but a bunch of family members, and I think that was the family, you know, got together and lent each other their shares of stock. So if you and I were brothers, Dean, I would borrow your shares, you would borrow my shares, and I would short your shares that I borrowed, and you would short my shares that I borrowed in a transaction that put on a perfect hedge to the long stock position that the family had in virtue of, you know, their ownership and development of that business. But because they had borrowed each other's shares, they weren't deemed to have sold their own shares. And so it was not considered a taxable event for the shares. Now, I can't remember exactly what year that transaction happened, but the trade made the New York Times quite famously. Turns out that trade was perfectly legitimate under the then current tax rules. But of course, it led to Congress to say that's probably not what we really had in mind strips the kind of capital gains being taxed on a realization basis. And so they changed the rule. So that type of trade became disallowed. That trade is sometimes known as short against the box. And that trade, if you did it after they changed the rules, you were deemed to have sold your stock, even though you actually technically hadn't sold your stock. But in changing the rules, the Congress allowed other types of hedging transactions to be undertaken, which weren't as complete hedges as a short against the box or as a swap might have been, but provided some protection on the downside and continued exposure to some of the upside, subject to prescribed limits of this new law. What we discovered, and I think you were right there with me, was that, you know, if you became well-versed enough in those rules and you could speak about them articulately to clients and to their tax advisors, even though we weren't the ones giving tax advice, we were simply giving those constituents the benefit of our experience, just being literate in those issues was a comparative advantage. And so our team, I thought, was reasonably effective as compared with the other teams on the street in pursuing that type of business, which was basically how a business described by assisting investors with concentrated stock positions to reduce risk in a measured way so as to achieve an economic outcome, but without triggering what then became known as the constructive sale rules, i.e. to have deemed to have sold your stock constructively, even though you hadn't sold it, in reality.
That was a fascinating time, that exploration, starting with the put-call combo, let's say, which of course would be deemed constructive as a sale, and then just widening it out from a collar standpoint and trying to figure out where that boundary lied. Obviously, you wanted to get that as tight as possible from a risk reduction standpoint, and that exploration process was really interesting. And bringing these trades together, Dave, across certainly trading, there's a pricing element there, there's vol risk, there's rate risk, and then you've got regulatory issues, you've got documentation is a big part of those OTC trades. Tell us about just the process of marshaling the resources, because you've got these different groups that become business partners, and you're the captain, you're trying to lead this to ultimately a transaction. So there's a lot of different constituencies that are in meetings, maybe after the close or maybe during the day, to try to figure out how to get there. I'd just love to hear your thought process on bringing those different businesses together in order to ultimately get to the trade.
Sure. Well, you're absolutely right. Those structured derivative trades were too involved, raised credit issues, potentially regulatory issues. Although we as the provider of the transactions, weren't giving tax advice. There usually would be someone who wanted to at least speak with tax lawyers that we knew, even if they weren't acting on our behalf. And there was all the documentation people who would paper the transactions. And then, of course, you needed risk approval from the firm to, to get the go-ahead that was okay to proceed. And so there are a lot of different people, professionals at the firm who would, have a view or say in the transaction. And it was usually left to, at least at Lehman, it was left to the sort of lead marketing person to corral those resources and get everyone's input, consent, in order to proceed. And I would say, at Lehman, one of the things that was great about that firm was there were really talented people in those sometimes referred to as more corporate areas. The legal team, the documentation team, just great people. And probably if there's a future life, I'm probably going to be in some place where people are keeping me awake in the middle of the night because I kept in the middle of the night trying to make sure everything was happening in the time frame that our clients needed. But it was wonderful. And what I discovered in that process is one of the things that really creates a lot of stability in an organization and a lot of glue for its personnel is that ability to be effective amongst the broader team. And it works because, like in a lot of things, if people trust you and people think you're an honest broker and you're not trying to give them 80% of the information and there's 20% that you're withholding, but it's actually quite damning to the initiative. If people learn to trust you that they're getting kind of the full picture, then things move quite smoothly, and it really sort of greases the wheels on making it all happen. And I'm quite sure that had bankruptcy never occurred, I never would have left the firm, because, you know, all of those frictions had been removed for me because of those internal relationships I'd built up over the years.
Well, let's talk about your transition to Europe just briefly, because I just think there's such a different set of products. They're sometimes much longer dated. They're very complex. There's a different buyer base. So the process of making those products is quite unique. Then I want to spend the bulk of our conversation just on your transition to the buy side and specifically founding GCW. As you transitioned to Europe for that period of time, tell us a little bit about that, just in terms of getting to know a different buyer base and motivation for implementing these trades. I'm sure the risk management for the traders was much different. Those products are very complicated sometimes. It'd be great to learn a little bit more about that.
One of the big differences between the European market and the U.S. market, and one that became, you know, was a problem for some of the European banks that were trying to do business in the U.S., is that the European market was a more intermediated market. And by that, I mean there were many, many more private banks in Europe that were catering to a more retail audience. So the big banks that had derivative shops like a Lehman or a Goldman or a Citi or Morgan Stanley at that time, they didn't deal directly with the individuals, but they would deal with the big private banks that would deal with the individuals. And, you know, you could walk down the street in Zurich or another European city and walk by a bank, you'd see like a poster that would advertise an equity derivative product. You would never see that in a U.S. city. You know, you'd see it's a very different kind of poster on the window of a bank in the U.S. city. But these products were, as you alluded, they were quite sophisticated. They were usually kind of complicated payoff type products where it would pay off, you know, the best of different indices, or there'd be, you know, downside protection, but coupons contingent on various events. I have to say they were complex products, but there was appetite for them in that market. And so the teams that were working in that business were teams that were staffed with kind of structured derivative traders that knew how to trade those products. There were product structures and knew how to put those products together. And then the sales relationships were with those intermediate institutions, such as the private banks.
One of the things I just always loved about those products, or maybe just about markets' ability to ultimately solve problems or to just find a way to transfer risk, is that whole industry that built up out of these very, very large structured product books in Europe and in Asia as well, that left dealers with dividend exposures, a lot of correlation exposures. And, you know, those got reconstituted quite effectively into the hedge fund universe. And I just think it speaks to the market's capacity to find a way to transfer risk from buyer to seller.
Right. That's a good point, because most of the trading guys didn't really want to wear those risks for the life of those products, which often could be years. And so they look for layoffs, what are called layoff opportunities. And the hedge funds, as they often are, because they're smart, savvy finance shops, were there ready and able to evaluate those risks and take on the ones that they were comfortable with.
Let's talk about now your move towards, call it the buy side, but the money management side of the business. So first at a large institution on the West Coast, and then ultimately founding GCW. How has that been different? What maybe starting before you actually established GCW, what your area of focus was, and the types of problems that you were trying to solve and the solutions you were finding?
Yeah, sure. One quick point maybe worth making that also connects the sell side to the buy side is when you look at those products that were so commonly sold in Europe, these complex structured derivatives, they were often sold or even chosen on a what's called a back-tested basis, i.e. a bunch of folks sitting on the trading floors would basically take a look at recent history of securities prices and find that combination of securities payoff such that the newly designed security that would designed to give that, offer that payoff, would look attractive. That was called backtesting. Of course, when you look at that, the whole mission is to find the security that is attractive on a back-tested basis. But, you know, the past is not a great predictor of the future. And so sort of an inherent problem with those securities is that one has little reason, simply based on the construction of the security, to believe that while it did well in the past, it's going to do well in the future. That is maybe a good segue into the buy side, because on the buy side, your responsibility is to figure out what might do well in the future. And certainly, you know, as a marketing person on the sell side, I was always kind of scratching my head about how attractive those products were. Kind of funny that the compliance refrain of past performance is not indicative of future results. It's a funny thing to come from compliance, because actually it's one of those truths that people should have in mind, whether your compliance officer is telling you that or not. It's just a truth. And connecting to the buy side, I'd say the real big difference is that on the sell side, you kind of measure success in terms of transactions, their frequency, the size of them. You know, obviously there's a measure of value to the bank in doing the transaction. That's often known at the time of the transaction. But on the buy side, when you invest, actually the start of the transaction is almost the beginning of the worry. It's not the declaration of victory. It's when you actually start to think, okay, how's it going to do? Because there's no win at the time you do a trade on the buy side. The win is sometime down the road when the thing that you've bought or sold actually pays off in the way that you had anticipated. And that's just a massive shift in thinking between buy side and sell side.
Just back to what you discussed on the data and the back testing side, and I think this is going to be something we explore with some of your current work. If we were to back test or try to establish, let's say, some sort of hedge ratio, some sort of sensitivity, you know, maybe we're trying to hedge credit risk with a put option on the S&P. We're certainly looking backwards to try to figure out how stable that relationship is. And there's a belief, there's an understanding the history does matter. And so backtesting is this really interesting thing where we all have to do some version of it. But you're spot on in the sense that, of course, something's going to win the backtest, right? You put a couple people with a lot of computing power in a room for long enough, and they're going to come up with something that looks pretty darn compelling. But it's likely some version of retrofitted and overly manufactured. So it's very interesting when we think about the past as not predictive of the future, but in some ways, especially on the vol side, there's some view of it mattering. If I found, I don't know, some relationship between two indices, maybe it's the Euro stocks and the S&P, and I see that historically Euro stocks trades, I don't know, a couple of vols over, and then for some reason, maybe it's the overwhelming presence of a structured product in the market, you can buy Euro stocks vol way below. Yeah, that's interesting, right? So it's a balance. It's really interesting.
For sure. Well, that the example you just gave there is maybe a good example of what my firm would call a potential market mispricing because of a supply and demand imbalance, which is the kind of phenomenon that gives you confidence to believe that there is a mispricing in the first place. And I would contrast that with a different view, which is, yeah, Euro stocks vol is low, but over the last 5 years, the Euro stocks outperformed the S&P. So buy this Euro stocks option because it did well over the last 5 years relative to, say, an S&P option. That's cherry picking, or, you know, what the statisticians refer to as data mining.
Right. There's a fair amount of that going on.
You looked over the sort of the universe of data and you found the thing that worked well.
You mentioned something there, and I think it's a good segue to some of what you're doing at GCW on behalf of your clients, which is trying to find opportunity. Investing is about deploying capital in areas where perhaps it's underserved, where the return expectation is high relative to the amount of risk, and you can get there in a couple of different ways. But that's certainly part of what you are doing at GCW on behalf of clients. I'd love for you to just talk about the risk mitigation side. My understanding is, just as you think about it, even as you have a very deep background in options theory and practice. That part of the market doesn't necessarily consume a lot of your time and is part of the what you're putting clients in. It tends to be a bit more on the maybe linear side. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about that.
Oh, sure. That's a good point. That relates to something else that you also referenced at the beginning of our discussion. I think you used the word equilibrium. And we try to apply equilibrium thinking to the things we do. Now, what do I mean by that? Equilibrium thinking means that when we take an action, we try to consider how the price of the security we're buying is influenced by the other participants in the market. Take options, for example. Price of that call option is in part determined by the appetite of someone who's selling that call option to have the risk associated with a short position in that option, or if they're a sophisticated trading desk, you know, the risk of trying to dynamically hedge that option over time. If that option is fairly priced, by which I mean if the volatility that underlies the pricing of that option, which, you know, you well know is known as the implied volatility of the option. If the option is fairly priced, then in buying the option, when you think about it, one is simply buying the actuarially fair representation of having access to the upside of a security, but not exposure to the downside. If it was a put option, because maybe this provides an example that is a little more intuitive to people, a put option is like a form of insurance because it protects you from depreciation in the price of a security. If you're long that, then that's insurance. If you buy that put option, it's priced actuarially fair, meaning its volatility is consistent with the actual distribution of possible outcomes of future stock prices for the underlying of that put option, then the reason to buy the insurance is if you're risk averse, not because you think you're kind of getting a free lunch by buying the put option, or you're getting some, you know, bargain, or you're getting something that's not available elsewhere. And that, of course, insurance is something that many people buy, and it's something that many people legitimately find additive to their portfolios, whether it's health insurance or property casualty insurance or securities insurance. If you're like us, by which I mean, because we haven't talked about my firm yet, if you are representing the interests of a generally wealthy client base, and one of the features, not necessarily, but one of the features that's often true of the wealthier client base is that they're a little bit more risk tolerant than average. So if you're a bit more risk tolerant than the average investor in the options market, then you really have to ask yourself, why would you be interested in buying insurance? Because the seller of the insurance is probably someone that is of average risk tolerance and possibly worse. So it doesn't make any sense with an equilibrium hat on to think of buying insurance when you're more risk tolerant than the seller. To you, you're probably not going to be buying it at the price that is actuarially fair, and maybe buying it at a worse price. So part of the equilibrium thinking is thinking of, well, does it make sense to purchase insurance? If I'm more risk averse than average, then that may well make sense. If I can't get the protection that I want, because maybe there's taxes that prevent me from selling, or there's a regulation that prevents me from selling, that might give me good grounds for buying the protection in option form. But otherwise, as a often more risk tolerant than average investor, I have to think hard about whether it makes sense for me to buy insurance.
It's the vol risk premium, just like the, as you mentioned, the insurance risk premium. You know, GEICO is not in the business of writing these car insurance contracts for nothing. They generally win, even though there's accidents all the time. And I think that vol risk premium over time is just unmistakable. And the corollary to the more traditional insurance markets, I think, is a strong one. And then there are these other periods, 98 with long-term capital, 2008, of course, the period just about 2 years ago on the eve of the pandemic, where, and I know hindsight can be 2020, but optionality is profoundly low relative to the powder keg that, again, in plain sight, sometimes is easy to say backward looking, but you know, there are some times where optionality just gets cheap relative to the facts on the ground, so to speak. And it's a hard one. People try to invest a lot of time in figuring out when that next landmine might occur. But certainly over time, that vol risk premium, as you say, just from someone trying to truncate their distribution and paying up for it, I think is very real. You started GCW before the pandemic. You were getting it underway, and then the pandemic hit. It'd be great to just learn a little bit more about the business side for you. Clients were obviously, it was a rough period in so many ways. Asset prices spiraled lower, at least for a period of time there. Love to get your perspective on that, just in terms of the early days of your business and how you managed through it.
Sure. Well, you know, we started this business because in some sense we thought there was a supply and demand imbalance, so to speak, in the market for investment management services. By which I mean, and that's just kind of maybe unduly, maybe that's the wrong language, too much jargon, but the idea was that particularly in Europe, where there's, again, this proliferation of private banks, there's a whole audience of people with high resources who are receiving their investment management services from organizations that we thought were in a bad position to deliver a great result. And we thought that for a lot of reasons, the private banks are affiliates of larger banks, have conflicts of interest in selling products on their own platforms, that even the placement of product on their own platforms was subject to the influences of other product lines at the bank. And therefore, there was possibly adverse selection in the choice of sponsors that appear on those platforms. There might be prime broker business, and the prime broker business wants to help that hedge fund. Or there's a bank sponsor business. And so the big bank sponsors end up getting their products on the platforms. Not a pure meritocracy. It's a choice that's influenced, at least influenced, by other considerations. And so we wanted to put together a model where our offering didn't have those conflicts of interest. There are a whole host of other things what we call imperfections that we sought to solve, like a lack of transparency in investment management services, a lack of accountability, because investment managers rarely are willing to commit to rigorous and meaningful benchmarks in evaluating their performance because they prefer to have the optionality that, you know, if they do well, they've done well, but if they haven't done well, they get to swap into a different benchmark and make themselves look better than they actually did. We were willing to commit to meaningful and rigorous benchmarks and hold ourselves accountable to outperforming them. So, you know, for all those reasons, we decided to create a model that expressed those values. That was really what underpinned the founding of GCW.
And just in terms of the process for finding opportunities, it seems to me that you and team are spending some time looking at private credit opportunities, kind of off the run types of investments where perhaps there's a premium paid for evaluating complexity or allocating to some opportunities that might be less liquid. What does that look like?
I would say the driving principle around our search. Let's go back to my the benchmark point for a second. So we apply rigorous, meaningful benchmarks that we announce and we publish all the time. And, you know, if we're outperforming them, we think we're doing well. And if we're underperforming them, then we think we're not doing well. And clients should also not think we're doing well. So those benchmarks are founded on a basic principle of finance theory, of modern finance theory, which you know very well, Dean, which is alpha. You know, we want to be able to deliver to our clients alpha. And alpha basically means that if our benchmarks are well-defined, that we can outperform the benchmarks, i.e. that we can create alpha. Because we have a lot of confidence in liquid, particularly liquid, highly liquid, large cap markets of publicly traded securities, we tend not to focus our energies on being stock pickers of a highly liquid, exchange traded, large cap securities of any type, because those markets are ones where there's, you know, an extraordinary amount of price discovery and transparency. And because of that, that price discovery process reduces the likelihood that you are going to have a view that is better than the market. Now, I don't think that's always true. I think there are plenty of players like skilled hedge funds whose business it is to try to do that. But we at GCW, we don't think that's our skill set. We're not a team of fundamental researchers trying to decide if Amazon is going to beat its earnings targets and therefore, you know, outperform what the rest of the market thinks it's going to do. That's not our skill set. We don't focus on those opportunities. We actually have a high degree of modesty, I have to say, in thinking about when we might have a conviction that the market has mispriced something. And that modesty leads us away from the highly liquid exchange-traded larger cap markets and towards the other end of the spectrum, which are less liquid or sometimes lower cap or thinly traded or sometimes the downright illiquid markets where price transparency, there isn't really a good price discovery process. And therefore, there isn't that competitive market mechanism to believe that, as they would say in finance, you know, today's price is the best predictor of tomorrow's price. And that leads us into kind of semi-liquid or even private securities. You know, in private securities markets, there, if you buy something, you could buy something, and because of improvements in governance or affecting improvements in operation or capital structure or other key attributes that all take a little bit of sweat equity as opposed to just equity, that you can deliver a meaningful improvement to the result. That's possible in private markets. That's not really available in more public markets. So one of the emphases we bring to portfolio construction is to, first of all, determine what would be an appropriate amount of exposure to illiquid securities in a portfolio, given a client's tax and circumstances, their own timeframes and potential spending needs and so forth. And then within that, once that illiquid target ratio is determined, then find within the private asset space, you know, really attractive opportunities where we can capture the most alpha.
Awesome. This has been a great conversation. And here's where I would be curious to get some further thoughts from you as we wrap up. Inflation. This is a new risk factor. It's something that was pretty dormant for 25 years or so. It really never much figured into the calculus of concerns. In fact, it was probably a tailwind in a lot of ways, right? We can argue in some ways that these high equity and risk asset values are themselves a result of the grind down to the lowest rates in a century or so. And that seems to be potentially coming undone, but certainly the purchasing power aspect of investing is on people's minds. I'd love to hear just how that might be changing. Again, just how you come about designing portfolios and big picture thinking about just protecting the wealth of your client base.
It's a very important question, and many people aren't, given how low inflation's been for decades, haven't really been thinking about it very much. But in a perfect world, inflation, if everything increased at the same rate of inflation, then inflation would be irrelevant because all prices and wages and financial products would all appreciate at the same rate of inflation, or put it in interest rate terms, the nominal rate might increase, but the real rate would stay the same. And it's, of course, the real return that matters. But in reality, actually, some things don't all move at the same rate of inflation. And in the securities world, one has to consider why securities might be more inclined to appreciate with the rate of inflation, and therefore you're what's called inflation protected by buying that security, or if some things might lag, in which case you would suffer a decline in the real value of the asset. Now, taxes are one of those reasons, historically speaking, because many countries' tax systems aren't properly indexed to inflation. And so companies that have greater exposure towards non-indexed features of a tax system are more likely to suffer in an inflationary environment than other companies. But I also think there's another dynamic that's at work in this current inflationary environment, and that is I think it's highly likely that there's a slight shift in the balance of power, so to speak, towards labor, which had suffered a lot over the last couple of decades with declining real wages. And now wages are being bid up as companies are trying to find talented labor that actually wants to focus on that job as opposed to do the other attractive things that are compelling demands on their time. And I think that's a fundamental dynamic here that is aiding inflationary pressures. And it's a dynamic that I think the Fed is one of sort of the key inflation fighting actors in the economy is relatively powerless to influence. I imagine that they're taking that into account as they think about how to combat inflation. But it might well be that at least for the foreseeable future, you know, modest increases in interest rates aren't really going to impact that more fundamental dynamic.
Yeah, it's going to be so tricky. It just feels very unpopular, inflation. No one likes to pay more for basic things. And I think as you suggest, the set of policies to ultimately bring it back down, it's just really unclear how much of what the Fed has done or can do actually translates into higher or lower inflation. There's all these complicated other issues, whether it's supply chain or demographics can be a big part of it. So it's going to be really interesting to see where it goes and then how market prices ultimately have to reset themselves should this view that this is just here to stay at a considerably higher level. It's going to be quite interesting.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to watch. You hit on another important point, which is the whole supply chain issue, which is also, you know, at least it's many of its origins are pandemic related, but coming out of that has been proving to be a challenge.
Well, Dave, we can leave it there. It's been awesome to spend an hour with you and get just the broad perspective, the arc of your career, both in academia in Washington, then on the sell side of Wall Street, and now in a money management position running your own firm. So it's been great to catch up, and I appreciate you spending the time.
Well, it's been fun, Dean. Thanks so much for the invitation, and you do a great job in running this podcast. Thanks so much, and congrats to you.
You've been listening to The Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.